Tuesday, January 5th, 1985. The bills under consideration are HB 115, 116, 117, 118, and 119.
35, we'll call the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. All members are present except Representative Pettijohn, who I expect will be here very shortly. And we have several bills on the agenda today. House Bills 115 through 119. All of them bills introduced by the Judiciary Committee for the Chief Justice of the last Supreme Court. Historical precedent for making that introduction that way. So
yeah.
It works out very well.
This is great. We did, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I move 115.
You move 115. Yeah. Well, that was going by sheer coincidence, Mr. Taylor. That was going to be the first bill that I brought up today. I want to make a couple of announcements first. To the extent that any of these bills can move out, I hope they will move out today. If all of them move out today, all the better. We do have a slight technical problem with 119. It's not really a problem, but an identical Senate bill has passed, and the tradition in the House and Senate is that whichever body's bill moves first, that bill is the one that is the instrument that's used to pass over the governor's desk. So therefore, we can hear 119 today. We can even decide to amend it if we want to, but we're stuck with having going through the five-day rule prior Thursday, Rule 23 hoops, and scheduling the Senate bill, at which time, whatever we decide today, we will tack on to the Senate bill, make any changes we want to make, and then move that one. But we can still hear the subject today, and we won't have to have the court system people come back. Mm-hmm. Mr. Sen?
I've just a point of inquiry here on the other bill. I believe on the continuation of the Board of Governors bar is coming up on Friday. Is that?
Yeah. That's, what do we have? Do we have your bill or the Senate bill?
Senate.
And that's the reason that bill was moving, so, and it's over months. So we will hear both your bill and the Senate bill, but because of the tradition of the House, it'll be the Senate bill that moves.
No, I just wanted to make a general inquiry to members of the committee if they had any specific issues they want to discuss on that bill. The president of our Harold Brown is in Ketchikan. He needs to come up here to do it, but he also needs to leave Friday morning at 8 a.m. and it is snowing out. So I was going to ask if it was necessary to have Harold here. If we want to get into some real in-depth stuff, he's willing to come and take his chances.
We could do it by teleconference if he doesn't want to leave.
That'd be just easy as well. Yeah, no reason for him to fly.
I'm assuming teleconference network would be available to us. It wouldn't be otherwise booked. If it is available, we could do it.
Don, do you have any problem?
I don't have anything that I know of now that I want to ask about. I think he should be by teleconference.
Yes. The last time that bill was before us, some of us almost made a career out of it, but there was all sorts of extenuating circumstances.
Well, that was his major concern, too, that 4 years ago it was a major issue, and that he's very concerned about it not being one this year. It would be here if the committee felt it necessary.
More Gordon, yeah.
The executive director will be here.
Is that tomorrow?
Randy, do you have any?
Hayden just told me that's on tomorrow.
I'm looking at
John's
on tomorrow. Yeah, it is on tomorrow.
And you want somebody to be here in person?
No, we're just asking if it's necessary for somebody to be here in person. It's already passed the Senate. Come over and ask.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Well, let's assume that it isn't necessary.
Yeah, I respect the tradition.
It'll be here. It will be on the board tomorrow. But we'll see if we can get a teleconference so that he can get his comments by teleconference. But my assumption is that I've heard no problem with anybody had with the bill. I think it's a sort of routine bill. So
okay, I'll give a call later.
Hey, can you check and see if we can get a telephone set up? I hate to be out of here.
There's going to be a difference. Mr. Chairman, if we're taking both bills, one bill.
No, it's the Senate bill.
It'll only be the Senate bill.
Are we going to take your bill too?
No.
Okay.
Just be the Senate bill.
So you're not pushing it?
No.
Okay.
Whichever bill passes the House first is what goes.
I was wondering if we were taking your bill too, because that was a difference.
No, it'll only be the Senate.
Okay, I'd appreciate that if we could do that. If not, well, we could carry it up a little bit.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
Then if it's only the one bill and it's non-controversial, maybe just the executive director wouldn't need to have it.
Right. I was just making a general inquiry to see if there was any real areas of inquiry he was willing to be here and take his chances.
Teleconference.
I just assume have teleconference in case something comes up. About the time we didn't have a teleconference, something came up and we don't have the answer. Instead, I want to announce to the committee, too, that the gavel will be in your hands tomorrow because I have to send a team out the road, and I won't be able to get back before the meeting is over.
Got a few bills on it.
Yeah.
Board of Governors, maybe, but we got some other stuff to move.
We'll see if we can get the television camera.
Kid that got a gavel and never worked on it.
Okay, the first bill we'll take up is House Bill 115, an act relating to setting a venue by Supreme Court rule. Certainly short enough.
Couple questions.
Mr. Phillips has a couple of questions.
Join the court system here?
Yeah. And for the record, why don't you identify yourself?
My name is Carla Forsyth. I'm general counsel for the Nebraska court system.
Number one, why are we doing this? Number two, the statutes seem to be changed quite a bit last year. I mean, it was 1984. So, I mean, this is real recent.
Mr. Chairman, let me just briefly explain why we're requesting this change. Right now, the venue statute provides that venue in criminal cases is situated in an urban area, here's where the crime was committed, within a judicial district and within a Senate election district. The Senate election district creates the problem. Every time the state is reapportioned, that means that the venue setting must change. That has an impact on jury selection, on transportation of defendants. The thought would be, what's a mechanism that we can use that will still achieve the constitutional goals that are important for venue setting, at the same time be easy to administer? And the thought would be the court can keep on top of that rather than having to worry about changing the statute every time that the state is reapportioned. The particular problem arises in right now in two locations in the state, and the one that's been of most concern to the court system is out in Bethel. Because of the way the judicial district cuts, there are people who should go to Bethel who, if you read that statute strictly, would have to go to Nome. Now, last year we did request an amendment, I believe it's a new paragraph G, that lets the Chief Justice by order provide for exceptions to the venue statute. That, we think, has gotten us over, we hope it's gotten us over any constitutional challenges in the meantime. But what this means is to figure out where venue is properly situated for a case, you have to look at seven separate documents, various Supreme Court orders, the statute, the court rule. The thought was to put it all in one place, and put it in one place where it can be easily found, and to put that in the Supreme Court rules.
Any further questions? Mr. Taylor and then Mr. Grimm.
It's my understanding, talking to Mr. Bloomberg, you wish this to be amended to have an effective date of January 1, 86?
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Mr. Bloomberg suggested that to me prior to the meeting. I don't know that I would say that that's something that the court system on its own suggests, but I do think it's a good idea. We will need some time to get the venue map together. I'm sure it would be, it may not be a year depending on when this measure passes. I had suggested 6 months. I don't know when a magic date would be. I think we probably could do it in the 3 months that would normally be the case, but I'm certainly welcome to suggest it gives a little more time.
Can we rest assured that if we enact this and we say 6 months or a year, that the Supreme Court will issue a rule and will modify?
We have on the administrative staff a rules attorney. His name is Don Bauermeister. He's been intimately involved with this. He's ready to go. The moment this legislation passes, he will get to work on a venue map. So I feel comfortable assuring you that will happen.
Mr. Greenberg.
Carla, would you rather have an earlier date than January 1, 86? What date do you prefer?
It really doesn't matter to me. I mean, again, part of it depends on when this measure passes. If we can assume that it's going to be relatively non-controversial, we won't have to wait until May. So,
I assume
August?
It has an automatic 90-day.
Right.
We don't do anything. It's got 3 months.
What I asked was whether she thought that she might need more than 3 months.
The more that, as we discuss this through, I don't think so. I think it might be easier just to stick with the 3 months. We'll have it done by then. And if we don't, we will certainly have it done then, I'm sure. But there have been other effective dates that have been passed by 1 or 2 days.
The thing I'm concerned about is that there would be a period of time when there's no venue rule. And I'd rather take care that there's no period, because this repeals the statute. And it's real important, because every day there are lawsuits filed in this state or criminal charges brought. This will apply both to criminal and civil. 90 days, let's say, from April.
Make it the day after session ends, May 20th.
90 days from there. Let's say the 1st of September.
That would certainly be satisfactory.
May I propose an amendment? I'd like to propose
that a new section 2 be added, reading as follows. This act, or the usual language, I guess it says this act takes effect September 1, or becomes effective, whatever the normal language is, September 1, 1985.
Okay. It's been proposed that the bill be amended. Actually, when we get done with this, I'm sure we'll use a committee substitute for the present discussion. Amend the bill to have a September effective date. Is there objection to that?
Okay.
Thoughts and objections?
Can I ask?
Sure, you bet. Go ahead.
I'm not quite clear from your discussion how long it's going to take for a rule to be submitted. I've often advocated for maximum public, or at least attorney involvement in the adoption of Supreme Court rules. The concern is that if this legislature gets out in the middle of May and they have till September 1st to adopt a rule, that we'll find a shortage of public involvement in the adoption of the Supreme Court rule. How long does it take to get a Supreme Court rule approved?
It can take from one day to forever, but in this instance, I think that probably what would happen is a couple of weeks to set it up, and it's not as if this is a new idea. There's a person on staff who's already thinking about it, who's already been talking with the area court administrators. I would say a couple of weeks to draft, run it by the Supreme Court, circulate it to the bar, assuming that that's what the Supreme Court wants to do, and they've wanted to do that with every rule change recently. So I would say that it can be accomplished in 3 months.
I'm not as confident. I'm going to continue my objection. I'd rather see January 1st or something like that. I think you're going to find, particularly in rural areas, an intense interest among the bar in what you're doing to venue.
Not only the bar in the rural areas, but the people and everybody else who's affected by it.
I'm willing to change the amendment. My thought was, when talking to Ms. Forsyth, January 186. I'm going to, if it's agreeable with the chairman, change it to January, and you're the person to make the motion, January 1, 1986. I believe we should err, if at all, on the side of giving the bar enough time.
For the record, Mr. Greenberg, you withdraws his previous amendment and proposes a new amendment, January 1st, 1986. Is there objection to that date? Hearing none, that date is adopted.
Or you could amend. That's one way.
Either way, I don't care.
And I'm just assuming that the motion also carries over for the entire, because that would have to be added up there. Yeah. No problem.
Yes.
Is there anything more we need to discuss on this bill? This is the easiest bill. I'd like to do this.
Well, I just have one question. You mentioned, maybe I missed the boat or something. You mentioned something about constitutional tax. What's the issue?
A Supreme Court decision in State v. Alvarado basically provides that a jury must be composed of a cross-section from the area in which the crime was committed.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court used language in that case suggesting that an appropriate way to figure out whether you've got a cross-section would be to use a Senate election district, which worked for a couple of years and then got us into problems. The problem in Bethel is if people whose community ties are with Bethel are having their trials conducted in Nome, the intercultural disparities might lead to a constitutional challenge. That's an issue that's not been litigated in Alaska.
So you say the problem is in Bethel and in Anchorage?
Right now, the problem occurs in Bethel, and it also occurs in Southeast, where I believe a strict reading of the statute would be. Representative Taylor, is that cases from Sitka would go to Cordova. Which is just a totally irrational result. And the problem is using the word Senate election district.
Yeah, they're in two different judicial districts, right?
No, they're in the same Senate district.
No, judicial.
Senate.
They're in two different judicial districts, but the same Senate.
Same Senate, so using the Senate district as the... Okay.
And in essence, what she's indicating is if you don't go as far as Cordova, you could literally or technically have a case arise in Yakutat that would be tried in Sitka, and literally it could occur that you would have a case in Metlakatla tried in Yakutat. Now that's a complete distortion, but it's possible under those rules. What has really happened over the years is that the major urban centers, of course, that's where all the jury trials occur. Nobody goes out in the bush and tries jury trials. So as a consequence, venue was always grabbed by the district attorney, who would then file in the major metropolitan area for a crime that may have occurred way out. And then the district attorney would insist that everything had to be tried in Anchorage or Ketchikan or Juneau or wherever, though the events may have occurred among a group of people that have no relationship at all, so to speak, to that city. I think allowing the Supreme Court to come up with something is probably a better shot than what we had under the old Senate district, but we are giving up something, and we need to be aware of that, and that is
that's
the
fine.
Political boundary lines, which at least assisted in requiring the court to adhere to certain ethnic and geographically similar groups of people when they select the jury panels. So we are giving that up, but
that's
I have faith that these people will do a good job of coming up with a better statute than we had.
I'd just like to move the committee CS for House Bill 115 with individual recommendations.
Yeah, I think Mr. Falk might want to comment first. Go ahead.
Well, I just have a couple questions or comments. First of all, the question you raised seems to me specifically addressed in the existing statute, because it says all prosecutions for crimes and offenses shall be commenced in the judicial district in which the crime was committed. And in fact, we could argue that that's an argument against the bill before us, because the Supreme Court, under pressure from the prosecutors, could adopt a rule that says you can file it wherever you want, in fact, creating the problem you're concerned about. I guess I'm just simply concerned about totally surrendering legislative prerogative over the question of venue, and that's what this does. If I could ask Ms. Forsythe, why couldn't the problem you raised be addressed under subparagraph G, which is the existing provision that says the Chief Justice may make exceptions to the requirements, et cetera. Go ahead.
Again, the thought on this was more of a thought of how to administer the thing. This works, but it means that you have to look at seven separate documents.
But that's the fault of the Supreme Court, with all due respect.
Well, those documents, not entirely.
Well, we only have one document.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court has several court orders and a rule.
The documents are, you need the statute, the rule, current election district map, a recommendation from the administrative director as to whether or not there are facilities in a particular community, because if there are facilities in a community and new ones are being built all the time, then you can have a trial there. A presiding judge order and also a chief justice order establishing a transportation exception. And the problem is that not only do the election districts change, but the facilities picture changes, and also the transportation routes change. Sometimes there are direct flights between communities, and sometimes there are not. The concept of keying it into Senate election district really isn't sufficiently flexible to meet the Alvarado standards to ensure that there is a cross section that may in fact violate that from time to time.
The state will let the record show that Rick Senator Jones. Thank you. Mr. Greenberg, or were you doing this one?
Yeah, I'm going to continue the objection.
I'd like to speak in favor of the bill. It seems to me that the present statute is not a very good statute, with all due respect to the people who asked it initially. And I think the Supreme Court, this is an area of procedure, and the Supreme Court can draft something that is more up to date, that is easier, and can get wide input from the people who are the most affected by it. And it seems to me to be very appropriate.
In response to that, first of all, the Supreme Court has no legal obligation to get any input whatsoever, which has always been a problem I've had with the Supreme Court rule adoption procedure. Secondly, they do not have as broad a constituency as this body does. And again, with the greatest respect for the Supreme Court, they don't have to listen to anybody in any rural area. They could adopt rules that clearly were biased in favor of hearing cases in urban areas, because that's more convenient, in my hypothetical, to prosecutors. I trust that they wouldn't do that, but we're giving up any of our oversight responsibilities over that process. Right now, it's a blend. It's a blend. We get something to say about it, they get something to say about it. We'll have absolutely nothing to say about it, and I submit it is not a procedural matter. It is a matter of some substance where you can bring an action based on venue.
May I respond?
Respond then, Mr. Clear.
First of all, the only reason that they are going to be involved in venue now is because of this statute. And there is enough oversight over the court system, enough people involved in the legislature who are involved in the court system in one way or another, whether lawyers or else or other things, that if the Supreme Court abuses its jurisdiction that's granted here, you can simply amend the statute. I think that the history of the Supreme Court is that they're very, very cognizant and protective of getting public input, particularly on things like this. And they're particularly protective of the Bush. The Alvarado case, with which I am somewhat familiar, was done exactly to protect the people in the Bush and the vicinage requirement. That's a constitutional requirement. And They can't ignore that any more than anyone else can, since they themselves established the boundaries of that requirement in Alvaro.
They adopted the rule that had to be struck down in Alvaro, too.
Well, but they've since dealt with Alvaro.
We'll let Ms. Taylor speak, and then it must be, if you'd like to move to that.
No, they didn't. That was a statute, by the way. Excuse me, that was a statute.
Right, yeah.
That was struck down.
Ms. Taylor. Gentlemen, believe me, the Supreme Court, I love this bill, because our legislature attempted to arrive at jurisdictional boundaries for our court system. Those have gotten confused by the political processes of Forsyth has indicated to us. But along with us confusing things in the political process, the Supreme Court on their own came up with Alvarado, which when it was first interpreted by the Honorable William Hansen of Nome, he had a case on King Island, and he'd read Alvarado. He got a hold of it. District Attorney Bill Garrison at the time, he says, Billy, we're going to go out to King Island and try this case. I want you to get hold of 5 airplanes, because I'm going to need my jurors. We're going to have to fly in food.
Sanders.
We're going to have
what?
And he started ticking it off, and he sent a bill down, a proposal down to Mr. Snowden, saying, I'm following Alvarado, and I want this fleet of airplanes, and I want that food flown out every day to my jury trial. All of a sudden, the Supreme Court decided that they might have just shot themselves in the foot. So that's when they started falling back on this situation, and they're saying, golly gee, if we have certain extenuating circumstances, then the Chief Justice doesn't have to send the Superior Court to King Island. We can bring everybody in to Nome. And then we get the attorneys fighting about whether the jury is made up of an appropriate cross-section. So I love this one. We just hand the whole problem back to him with Alvarado and say, now figure it out. And like Don, that's why I asked him to do it. When are they going to come up with the rule? You know, they got a guy on the stand. Hopefully he'll do it. But now it's not our problem anymore, unless they abuse it. If they do, I'll be happy to take it up with you.
Just the final response is that I think there's a solution short of abdicating our responsibility here, which is to amend the statute to deal with the Senate district problem. Having said that, the motion is individual recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
I'll withdraw my objection.
Mr. Senator, move that the bill be turned out with the amendment in the form of committee substitute. The amendment, Mr. Pettijohn, establishes an effective date of January 1, 1986. Okay. Is there objection to that motion? Hearing none, the motion passes. The bill will be turned out with individual recommendations. And the staff will circulate the committee report. The next one up will be 116. We have a representative. We also have a proposed committee substitute that I understand is fairly. Changes are fairly minor in nature, but necessary. We have a representative from the Judicial Council. You want to join us at the table?
Line 6 on page 2.
Yeah, wherever it happens.
I 45 to 90.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Reading through this bill, it appears to me this just allows the Judicial Council to begin working sooner towards replacing someone who obviously is not going to be there. Is that correct?
If you're asking me, I think yes. Let's ask. Will you identify yourself?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Fran Bryson, Director of the Judicial Council. The difference between the committee substitute and the original bill is directly your observation is correct. That it simply allows the council to be earlier. The main thrust of the bill, though, I think, is simply to conform the statutes regarding retention to the provision of the Constitution, which puts it.
You just threw me off considerably. My understanding of the original bill was to resolve a problem about when the seat was vacated if a person didn't file an intent to be reelected, whatever we're calling
retention.
It. And prior to the amendment, I thought that was the purpose of the bill. Can you confirm that?
Maybe Carl should speak to that. That's my understanding.
That is correct, that was the purpose of it, but...
So the effective date is the date of the election.
Right.
That's what the language on line 17 and a half says.
Right, it would be 90 days after the election, right.
And the effect of the proposed amendment now, the 90-day amendment, is in fact to give the Judicial Council more time, twice as much time, to act following the election.
That's basically correct, although it's not the election situation that poses the problem, Representative Blackson. The problem typically arises when a judge simply retires or resigns, a vacancy in fact occurs other than related to an election, and then the council, in order to comply with the statute, must meet within 45 days. At the time these statutes were originally enacted, there was no bar survey, there was no process of interviews or reviews that the council had to go through in order to make its recommendations. That process now takes about 75 to 90 days, and the only exception in the current statute is if you can't meet within 45 days, you have to request a Supreme Court permission. Basically, what's happened in the last few years is the council, every time a vacancy occurs, has to request a Supreme Court permission to do it because it takes about 90 days. The suggestion simply is to recognize the reality.
If I can continue, the concern, of course, is that in the situation being addressed here, that is, where the judge decides not to file a notice of declaration, you have whatever that period of time is. When is it? How much prior to the... What's the gap between the deadline for filing a declaration and the election?
90 days.
So you'd have a total of 180 days between the time you knew that a judge was going to leave and the time that you would recommend a replacement to the Supreme Court in those situations.
Well, you see, but the other part of the statute, which is unchanged, says that any time there's an impending vacancy, the council can meet any time 90 days prior to that. That's unchanged. This is simply saying when a vacancy occurs...
No, but that specifically excludes the failure to file declaration of candidacy.
Line 23.
Line 23 and a half, yeah.
Mike?
My concern is a real long gap where you know ahead of time that the judge is not going to seek his or her seat again.
In that situation, the council can meet any time...
after the deadline for filing a declaration, right?
That's
I mean, they could
correct.
Start the process.
That
then.
Is correct, and that would not be changed. That still continues to be the case.
Except that they could take up the 90 days.
But since once the council is aware that an individual has failed to file for retention, the council can meet. And that is not changed by this statute. The only situation that would be changed is a situation where basically, I think, where a judge resigns or a judge dies and a vacancy occurs and the council has to meet and can't meet within 45 days.
That's what I'm just getting at. The fact that a judge sends in a letter of resignation or retirement triggers a time frame that you are then required to meet with them. Maybe you had planned to meet the 15th of March and everybody was scheduled for it, and then 45 days or 50 some days before that, you get notification from a judge that he's retiring. Then you got to move the whole calendar up. Primarily, it's just a convenience thing for you, isn't it? So that you can have more regular meetings without inconveniencing your council. I'd like to applaud the council for one thing while they're here, Mr. Chairman. They have had three or four vacancies that I'm aware of just in the last year and a half. And on each one of them, the one in particular in our district that just occurs, I've seldom seen the council move with such dispatch at getting something done. You know, Judge Keene filed his retirement notice, I think, about the first of the year. They've already concluded the advertising period, and the final names have been submitted to the council for their review. There'll probably be a name going to the governor, I would imagine, within, 45 days or so.
In March, someone will meet.
So I think that's very prompt action, and they've indicated the things they've actually done indicate that they've done the same thing as the previous one. So we don't have any big delays.
Mr.
Gunter,
this is a question, and I don't know whether it's a problem or not being new here. It's in the title. It's a gut feeling. And I'm concerned about people tacking other things onto this bill, like new judgeships and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And my concern, if anybody else feels as I do, whether we ought to limit the title law.
You'll have to.
Phillips?
on the title change, you don't you have to go back to the sponsor?
No, not as long as it's in the same house, we can do it.
I'm concerned about doing it in the Senate, frankly, and I would suggest, I'm not making an amendment because I don't, I think I may be right, but I'm not sure, that we consider limiting the title.
And, Mr. Chairman, now that my interest is, has peaked, I have an amendment.
Which way?
New section. New section, add a new Superior Court Judge in Ketchikan.
Section six.
I've been waiting for a long time for something like this to come along.
I request that, that staff or somebody work on a limiting thing. I don't want to see this become a Christmas tree.
Can I get some feeling from the rest of the committee on this?
Fine with me.
Even if we put some word on here that says, that's all this act is for and don't nobody touch it, they got every right to do anything they want.
No, a bill cannot be amended in the title in another house. So if this bill goes over to the other body, they couldn't change the title and they couldn't change the meaning of the bill. For instance, to add another judgeship. They couldn't add another judgeship in the other house if they didn't change the title. And by precluding them from changing the title, that would include.
That's one of our rule changes, maybe one.
What we might do on this, we might give staff the directions to have that done. I just do not hold the bill, but what we could do is give him instructions to do that. We can move the bill out of the committee as far as this meeting is concerned, but we could bring it around to each of you to make sure that title is satisfactory before we send the bill over to clerk's desk.
Or maybe Mr. Brimson or Ms. Forsyth has a suggestion. I don't have any thought, but I think
they probably haven't even thought about that. Yeah. That is devious.
I still would like to make a motion to have a new judgeship.
I have an amendment to your motion.
Shall we play Can't You Top This?
We'll do that next session.
Okay, do we have any further questions about this bill and this budget?
With that understanding, limiting the title, yes.
I move the bill out with individual recommendations with an amended title.
Mr. Grinberg moves the bill out with individual recommendations with amended title. The mandatory language will be circulated among members of the committee before it crosses the clerk's desk. If there's any problem, we'll bring the bill back to the committee and you can push it around. Do I hear any objections?
You bet I'm thinking, Max, but I bet you don't know what I'm thinking about.
I don't. I know you well enough to know I don't know what you're thinking.
Do I hear objections to that motion? Hearing none, the bill moves out.
What's that?
John just lost a great chance.
Come on, just put a bill in, let it go up and down the stairs.
We'll go ahead and sign it right now, but I wouldn't.
John,
I
don't agree with you.
I'm going to need so many judges here when he gets back and gets report to us.
Okay, the next bill we take up.
All we're going to do is give Anchorage three more.
Is House Bill 118. I understand we have
117.
What about 117?
Excuse me.
We don't have a 117. Yes, we do. Okay.
CPA bill.
Employee folks.
This is the first time I've ever helped the CPAs. I don't know.
We're moving along pretty well. This next bill will be House Bill 117, an act relating to appointment qualifications and duties of an internal auditor within the last report system. There is a fiscal note in your files on that for fiscal 86 under the IFL. Did everybody get a fiscal note?
Mm-hmm.
If you want one, okay.
It's probably for auditor staff.
Does anybody have questions? Go ahead.
Ken.
Do any other agencies of government have an internal auditor?
I'm not sufficiently familiar with the way the executive branch is structured to be able to answer that. I think they did it one time. I know that a parallel would be the municipality of Anchorage should have an internal auditor.
I don't think, Mr. Chairman, any of our departments have internal auditors.
Why can't we just privately contract this out? And we have Arthur Young or somebody.
Well, I could throw in at one time the executive branch had an internal auditor because I knew the guy. Now, it may have been abolished, I don't know. But there was an internal audit division within what has now become OMB, and I don't know whether they still carry that title and function or not. But at least one time, I don't think any departments have. But on the other hand, the court system is not one of the departments of state.
Equal branch. Can I answer the question?
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, about why couldn't this be contracted out? I mean, I know a legislative affairs agency, we contract out to, we put a bid opening for auditors come in, and then we award the contract to the auditor and they come in and audit the agency. Is there something wrong with that, or?
This was a recommendation to legislative audit. It's my understanding that the recommendation was to structure it as an internal position. I don't know whether there was any financial assessment made. I think part of the reason for keeping it as an internal position is feeling that it is going to require a full-time responsibility. It would be a full-time independent contractor and would probably wind up costing the same thing. But to be honest with you, I don't know whether that sort of financial analysis of the contractual approach has been made.
Why does it take a full-time person? I'm not quite clear about what they're going to do. It seems to me if you do like an annual audit, it takes a few months or something like that, but not a year-round job.
Well, the court system being as far-flung as it is, and remember that we're talking about the courts that range in sophistication from part-time magistrates to major metropolitan courts, and oftentimes the part-time magistrate locations, which are still required to account for transactions, because we are talking about outlying areas where perhaps the magistrate is not as experienced in financial matters, there may need to be some more time, more than would normally be apportioned in the metropolitan area. Also, the court system is involved in just a wealth of trust accounts, various sorts of funds that come in and through the court, bail money, bond money that's deposited. It's really a very major operation, which occupies a full-time staff just doing the fiscal accounting that's required, and there really hasn't been the opportunity for anyone to go out and audit those with any sort of independence who isn't more or less involved in the transactions themselves.
A couple other questions.
Go ahead,
then we'll say, when you finish your line, you want to go first. Recommendations go to the administrative director, and the administrative director hires this person. And is there any reason why that couldn't be the Supreme Court, who are the ones who run the court system?
Under the Constitution, the Supreme Court is authorized to hire an administrative director, and under Administrative Rule 1, the Supreme Court delegates virtually all its administrative responsibilities to the administrative director. Certainly the Supreme Court is involved in signing off on that.
Including the authority to set venue?
Cute question.
No cigar.
This would be a position on the director's staff. Feels that that's a position he should hire.
So if we said it was the Supreme Court that made the decision and that got the report, the Supreme Court would probably just delegate it to the administrative director anyway.
I would suspect.
My final question is with regard to the information, the sub D on the top of page 2. It's a pretty complete grant of access to all records, including presumably some confidential records, because it says that you can't authorize public disclosure. Is it clear in your mind that the auditor will have access to confidential court system records?
Well, that certainly is the intent, and the reason for putting that in there is that oftentimes the financial transaction may require looking at some records to understand the substance that goes along with the procedure. And the thought is that by specifically saying that disclosure isn't authorized, that would be an adequate protection.
Would the person who hired the auditor have the authority to see this confidential information? That wouldn't necessarily
would
be public
not.
Disclosure.
No, I would suspect not necessarily.
How firm are you in that opinion?
You could structure it so that it could happen either way. My thought would be to structure it so that would be information to which the director was not privy.
And the final thing, I'd like to see this legislative audit report that recommended this. You said that before, and frankly, before we moved the bill.
Me too.
One question. We can hold this over.
Would this position then supplant or replace the responsibilities of the Office of Management and Budget? In other words, would this make the court system have its own internal auditor, and then OMB would be out the door?
OMB has nothing. See, they're the executive branch only.
Legislative budget and audit, though, is
okay. That's
a
question.
Right. Yeah.
We would still be subject to their audit on us. Once every 3 years, I believe, is the time span for that. But their recommendation, I will get a copy of the report between the meetings now, is that we need something ongoing.
Mr. Sons, and Mr. Page, and Mr. Grimm.
Do you have any examples? examples or evidence of misuse of funds or some reason why we need an auditor? Do we have a scandal running around or?
If we do, I'm not aware of one. I don't think that's the motivation here. I think it's just that the court system has become such a large operation that this is something that is needed. And then it will assist and make the legislative auditor's job perhaps a bit more efficient. It's some things that they're not able to go into right now. I think that's the best thing, we need to get a copy of the report and get that recommendation.
I guess my comment would be that the executive branch is much larger than the judicial branch, and it doesn't have an internal auditor.
Yes.
Mr. Pettyjohn.
Report that Mr. Clarkson requested. I would request in advance of the meeting that we consider the bill that be distributed to the members so we can review it.
Well, hopefully we will consider the bill tomorrow. All these bills are scheduled for tomorrow if we don't dispose them today. So if you could see that they get to each member's office, that would probably help. And that way we could look at them before they came to the meeting.
LB&A may have a bunch of copies. You can just get copies of them.
Okay, Mr. Taylor, you had a question?
Well, no, just a comment. I'm well aware of the need for this position. A lady by the name of Marge Lorich has done a fantastic job from the system for many, many years, flying all over the state, going into these small magistrate posts and cleaning up their books. She can get in there, if we're real lucky, she may hit half the posts once a year. And for her to hit every post in the year, there's 50 of them. She's really got to be doing some good. So when she gets in there, she oftentimes finds difficulties with untrained people that have been handling fines and bail money and other things for which we as a state are responsible to those people. And a person of this type to give her some expertise and help may very well be necessary to have some. I think many of us feel it's probably may not be too much of a justified position in light of the budgetary problems we're having, but I know there is a need for it. I can recognize part of that.
Just have one comment. I'd rather have a judge than an auditor.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs about the same.
May I inquire if the gentleman from Kent County that could be located in the southern part of the state?
We can start with one there and work our way north.
Well, we could say act related to the point of the qualifications.
If our legislative budget not for people suggest this, I think must be a pretty good reason why it's good, solid business procedure. So I'm sort of disposed to take their word for it.
Yeah.
But I agree that we should look at the report, which we'll have before us. Is there anything further on this bill?
Let me just say that I'm somewhat hesitant about this bill. I'm not as excited about it as you are. And you may want to move it, and that's fine. But I'd like to look at the report and reserve the chance to at least request that the auditor come down here.
Sure,
if
no problem.
Not enough in the audit itself. I kind of want to look into it further.
No problem.
I think that
actually
sounds right on.
In fact, why don't we just count on that? Let's just ask if he can come over tomorrow.
Okay.
If there's a problem, and members can satisfy themselves. I have no passion involved in the bill.
Okay.
If it moves, it doesn't. It's fine. We've got a nice way to find a change. House Bill 119.
Number
118. I'm sorry. Yeah. I keep getting ahead of myself.
Small claims.
An act relating to small claims, jurisdictional limitation, and duties of magistrates. You have a. Fiscal note in your file?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm sorry, you should. For
no backup, no fiscal note.
Fiscal note, please. Should total some $105,000.
For this bill?
I beg, no.
No, that was the bill prior. Mm-hmm. That's on the auditor. It shouldn't cost anything.
No, the other
were just brought down today, and they're up in Xerox. So
oh,
some of them got in.
Are zero? Zero?
I don't know.
Zero.
No, the last bill was $105,000.
Right.
This bill is
$1,058.
I have a copy of the fiscal note.
Let's just tell us.
Okay, the fiscal note is for 3.5 court clerk ones, 1.5 in Anchorage, 1 in Fairbanks, 1 in Juneau. Those are just about the lowest range in which a court system employee can come into the system. These are people who stand behind the front counter and process the small claims. The reason for putting in a fiscal note on this is we're anticipating the increase will lead to more access to small claims, that there will be a substantial number of new cases generated. The civil supervisor in Anchorage has estimated a 20% increase in small claims. And Juneau is a very litigious center in terms of small claims activity. And the thought would be that these are going to be some new cases in the system. These are not cases that for the most part are presently being heard in district court because it simply costs too much to hire an attorney to prosecute a $4,000 case on one's behalf. And these sorts of cases are the most labor-intensive, and they do require explanation to the litigants.
Mr. Sen?
Isn't that a good reason not to do this?
Yeah.
To say that to force the resolution of these types of issues outside of the court system? I mean, they do get resolved.
No, they don't. That's the problem.
Night court.
Mr. Pettyjohn?
Well, John, you got a case for $4,000, and you can't afford to hire an attorney. But you can't go to, if you go to small claims court, you don't give up half your claim. So what's a guy do? You know, he may just it may not get resolved at all. He's just out of pocket.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm getting a little bit warm here because, as Don says, I may have missed my chance, but the reason we're not putting a Superior Court judge into Ketchikan is because it costs too much. It costs about $100,000, and now I got two bills in a row here that are $105,000 fiscal notes apiece, so we can put two judges in for the cost of doing this.
Mr. Chairman.
And it just kind of bugs me a little bit. Bills came up in the wrong order.
Yeah. Mr. Pettyjohn, and then Mr. White.
Well, Mr. Sen, with all due respect, I really think you have to check with somebody in the court system about the actual cost of a Superior Court judge with regard to a courtroom, bailiff, a clerk, equipment, and juries, and all kinds of good stuff. Probably find this a little bit harder than this.
That was $210.
Sorry, help you, Your
Honor. Mr. Schultz,
yes, they know.
No, I did. Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I always want to make a statement, but maybe I can ask. Yes, I did raise my hand, but it was going to be a question. I was just looking for the court rules on small claims, and it's been a while since I've been involved in small claims. Are there presently any limitations on the access of small claims by attorneys?
No.
The use of attorneys in small claims actions?
No.
And what is the argument for this, for not limiting the use of attorneys?
Well, you know, it's basically a philosophical decision which way to do it. I think the main argument in favor of permitting attorneys is that often there are cases, mainly the collection cases, that oftentimes involve an attorney, that it's more efficient to bring in small claims, and just because an attorney is able or willing to handle one of those cases shouldn't deny a company or an individual the right to have an attorney there. Of course, there are arguments on the other side.
There are. What percentage of the small claims cases are brought as collection activity, and what percentage are brought by corporations?
I don't know those figures, and to be honest with you, those aren't figures that I would be able to get for you, because our figures are not kept that way.
And your experience with those pieces. And I read the small claims list in the Anchorage paper, and it's predominantly collections, and it's predominantly corporations. Is that your perception as well?
I think that's the case nationwide as well as in Alaska.
What efforts have been made? These look like original. What efforts have been made by the court system to encourage mediation and conciliation and arbitration of small claims cases?
The court system really has not made any efforts along those lines. The court did recently fund a project through the Conflict Resolution Center to study the possibility of diverting some small claims cases to CRC for mediation and possible arbitration.
Has any action been taken on that report or any efforts made by the court system to divert cases from the small claims court?
Not really. That's something that the court has not pursued.
Well, I guess I would be concerned, first of all, I think many of these cases are appropriate for mediation, conciliation, and arbitration if necessary. And it seems I'd be inclined not to support an expansion of jurisdiction with the accompanying costs unless there was some effort by the court to restrict the access to small claims to what I would consider people who ought to be in that court, which are people that can't typically hire an attorney because the case isn't important enough to justify the cost. And I'd sure like to see efforts in those two directions. That is, towards mediation arbitration as a way of resolving problems rather than going into the court system at all. And secondly, creating some savings in the small claims court by restricting access. You can expand the jurisdictional amount if you want, or if we want, but that should be accompanied by some limitations too, like prohibiting attorneys.
That's my list here. Mr. Phillips, Mr. Greenberg, Mr. Taylor.
Is it possible to put a user's fee on this bill? In other words, pay for, you know, they come in, both parties pay X amount to pay for these people here, $105,000.
My understanding is that basically it's not possible to do that, and it has to do with the constitutional prohibition against use of the funds. That right now the filing fee that's charged for small claims, along with all the other court system filing fees, reverts to the general fund. And it's my understanding that that in this state there's no constitutional restrictions against saying, you know, a $25 filing fee, which will be plowed back into small claims for fund staff.
No. What I'm saying is, you can dedicate it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't dedicate it, but you can just collect it and put it in the general fund. So what? If at the end of the year the small claims guys add up the total and it happens to be $105,000, I mean, it seems to me we should have something there where they have to pay for it. I don't, you know, $105,000 is a lot more than 50 now.
Mr. Greenberg, name of the
table. Let me just see. If I may explore the area Mr. Phillips was talking about. Ms. Forsyth, you have here on the fiscal note, or Mr. Fisher has on the fiscal note, maybe he'd be the person to ask on this. A 1.5 court clerks in Anchorage, one each in Fairbanks and Juneau. That is based upon how many court filings statewide in a year?
Hold on just a minute, I can give you that information.
Absolutely. I'm going to pursue that.
Okay, for fiscal year 84, which ended July 3rd.
You know, my question very precisely is, the additional personnel are based upon an expectation of a certain number of additional filings.
Mm-hmm.
What is that number?
I'd have to make a computation. I've got the FY84 filing, and it's expected that those would increase 15% to 20%.
Okay, if you give me the figures, we'll...
We'll do the math.
It's not particularly difficult math. 5,000 cases in Anchorage, 1,100 in Juneau, 950 in Fairbanks.
That's 7,000. So plus a 20%, 8,400.
And just to add on to that, because occasionally Anchorage does help out with these locations, 650 in Palmer and 420 each in Kenai and Ketchikan. It's about 8% of the total district court caseload.
What's the Fairbanks one?
950.
7,500
times
20%.
Times 20%.
Right.
Right.
16,000.
1,700. For 1,700 new cases statewide, is it necessary to hire 3.5 new people?
Mr. Hoover, when I passed this bill out to the people who are in charge of the small claims division, they said, we need the bodies, we're dying as it is. No one understands how much work it takes, how much time it is behind the front counter. We really need these people. To a certain extent, these personnel projections are subjective. It's really difficult to know how many cases translate into a need for new bodies. But I know that the people that actually work in this operation really feel that if the jurisdiction increased, they would be getting a lot of new cases and would really need some new help.
The filing fee is now $10, right?
I think it's $5.
Right. It's only $5? How about if we were, now is that set by administrative rule?
Yes.
How about if we were to raise the filing fee from $5 to
$20? 15, sorry.
15.
We'll do it. Well, that's an additional $10,000. And that would be and that would be for everyone. And how many total, Carla? Did you say this would be total
statewide?
Yeah, for all small claims.
10,400.
10,000. That would mean we'd get $100,000. That would mean instead of costing $104,000.
Now,
I'm way behind you guys.
Well,
administrative code is the setting of the rule. I mean, the fees are set in the administrative code, right?
In the administrative rule, yes.
Okay. It seems to me there are two ways, at least two ways of skinning the cat. Either we put it in statute, or we provide an effective date, that this act takes effect on the date the Supreme Court raises the rule, the fee.
I like that.
And I suggest the second method.
Or we simply recommend it.
Well, I don't want
it.
To just do it on a recommendation with respect
to it.
I would like to have the body consider making an effective date, effective upon the raising.
Okay, I have people in order, otherwise we're going to justify the upset. Mr. Taylor, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Sound, Mr. Pettison.
Fact has covered most of my mind. I love his last concept, and I think we should also add to that by contacting the Bar Association all of the cases that have been under advisement for over 9 months and say that they have to render judgments on those before it's done.
Forget it.
I guess my only comment is that if this is going to increase the load to the filing clerk, this is going to increase the load to the district court judges, I guess, whoever hears this case. And this is just the beginning of fiscal note policies that you guys have ever seen. I mean, if you got more filing clerks, it's going to be more throughput, and it's going to stack up on the judge's desk a lot higher. My suggestion is leave it alone, don't give any more clerks, and just make them wait longer. What is the average wait time that small claims court or cases filed and it's tried, or a decision is rendered?
Yeah, I don't have that figure, but it's not very long, within the 2 months, something like that. I'm dealing with
the district court. Very seldom tried, huh? I've got 90%+ of my defaults. So the Sonia shows up.
Representative Sonia, the bulk of these are in Anchorage, and Anchorage does have new district court judges.
That was because the other ones were on. I bet you they're all busy, too. You know, they're not sitting around, hopefully, in their office.
Well, certainly they're not, but the feeling is that this is something that could be restored.
Can we? Who was it?
The City Council brings up an interesting point. If we attempt to, I'm not sure this would be the case, but if we attempt to change the court rule, it's going to take 2/3 of the bodies.
I think we'd get it.
An effective date is not an amendment of the rule, so we don't have to have 2/3 for that.
You have to have 2/3 for an effective date.
The thing about it is, you have to have 2/3 for an effective date. If the effective date fails, it becomes law 90 days.
Right.
So you hang yourself on
that. Yeah.
Mr. Phillips and then Mr. Pettigrew.
Oh, I'll pass. I like what Max is doing.
Well, first I'd like to suggest a refinement on this revenue raising thing for the discussion purposes here. If you raised it to $15, you know, that what we could do is you could leave it at $5 unless the amount in question was over $1,000, in which case it would be $15 or $20. It wouldn't be as easy to calculate it in, but if somebody's got a $107 claim against somebody, and then they're going to have to put in $15. And in many of these cases, you have to understand, Max, maybe you do, but I know I do, is that you may never really think you're ever going to get the money. The guy skipped town, or he left his apartment, or he ran off, and you don't know that you're ever really going to get him. Now, for $5, just say, to heck with it, I'm going to sue him, and, maybe I'll get a judgment against him, and, I may never see him again, but I know satisfaction. I did that. But if you make them plunk out 15, they might say, well, I'm not even going to bother with it. It's just $15 more I'm going to be out of pocket. So if you adjusted that, so if there was over 1,000, say, then okay, well, then you're going to maybe be willing to pay a higher fee, but if it's under that, no.
May I respond to that? I don't have a problem with what you're suggesting, but may I suggest another way of examining that, if I may address Mr. Pettigrew. Would be that if these cases are so small and so problematic, first of all, $15 is a relatively modest amount, and it would be recoverable in the judgment. But maybe some of those cases shouldn't be filed. And it comes to a point where these de minimis kinds of cases just clog the court system. And I don't have any problem with putting $15. That may discourage a few of these, and that would lower it a little bit, but I don't have a problem with what you're saying, but this is another way you might consider.
Yeah.
Taylor, that's welcome.
Presently, the jurisdiction stops at 2,000. By this bill, we're increasing the jurisdiction into what was the province of the district court by $3,000. We're going up to $5,000. All of those people who previously had a case and wanted to file it paid $25 for the privilege of going into district court. I just throw that out as an example. You're giving them, you're going from $25 filing fee to a $5 filing fee in essence. Why not just put it right at $25? Right straight across the board. And you may get rid of some of these chicken $100 cases too.
Mr. Gunberg.
Well, I just have to disagree with this whole trend here. The fact is that the largest portion of the citizens of this state, the only time they see the inside of the court building is to file a small claims action. And I'm disturbed at the tendency of some members of this committee to discourage normal citizens who think they're aggrieved from trying to file lawsuits. We ought to make it easier for them, not harder. Crowding in the court system is not the fault of the $102 to $500 claims. It's the procedures being used in some of the more complicated cases. So I would not support an increase in fees, even if we could do it as opposed to the Supreme Court doing it. And I'd rather change the focus or redirect the focus of the small claims court to address those people that it ought to be a service for, people that can't get any other help because they can't get an attorney, and they can't get into district court or superior court. So I really disagree with the idea that we ought to be discouraging people from filing cases in these courts because they're too small. And by the way, I would just ask for a revised fiscal note to reflect the revenue increase. When it works out to whatever we decided it was going to be, not that much money, but I think in order to be accurate, the fiscal note needs to reflect that. Everybody here understands that it will go into the general fund, but I'd ask that that...
I'd like to respond.
Mr. Gunberg, Mr. Phillips, and Mr. Taylor.
The suggestion I was going to have was that, and this is just a thought, that the act would take effect on the date the Supreme Court amends Administrative Rule 25C2 to cover the fiscal note. And they could do that in a variety of ways. They could do it in a way that Mr. Pettyjohn has suggested. They could do it in a way that Mr. Taylor has alluded to, because there's actually, it's going to be cheaper for people to go in for $5 than it is for $25 now. They could do it in any one of a number of ways, and frankly, I would rather leave it to the court system to set the fee than putting it in statute. And this is my suggestion. I'm not making a motion at the present time, but it would be, it takes effect on the date the Supreme Court amends this administrative rule to cover the fiscal note. When I say covered, I mean if it's $105,000, $100,000 would be sufficient.
Mr.
Elfish,
go ahead.
My only comment is that the filing fee right now is $25 for 60% of the group that you're talking about. I'm not looking at Representative Fox as some sort of penal thing. I'm only suggesting that most people aren't even going to waste their time for those smaller cases anyhow anymore. And a $5 filing fee is very antiquated at this point. I have a hard time buying a hamburger in this town for $5. I don't get the opportunity. You're opening up a door for $5 that involves a tremendous investment on the part of the people and the rest of it. I don't think it's considered quite as significant as the $5 was when they first enacted this thing probably 15, 20 years ago. Maybe it's just time for an inflationary adjustment to it.
I just wonder if Mr. Grunberg's idea is going to cause some kind of a problem.
Making a law, the effective date of the law, contingent upon the change in a court rule. If we would have thought of this earlier when we gave the courthouse, the court system a new courthouse, we could have made that bill contingent on their changing one of the criminal rules, I imagine.
Sure.
Which is an interesting concept, I must admit, Representative Grunberg. But I wonder if the counsel for this committee could see if there is any precedent for that having been done, making a statute.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, a statute contingent on the court changing a court rule and only getting a 50% or getting a majority in each house to pass the bill, but nonetheless having the effective date contingent on a court rule change. That's a very interesting concept.
Mr. Greenberg.
Don't we need the two-thirds for the effective date?
Yes.
So it's the same as we do for a court rule?
Yes, the two-thirds.
So it's still two-thirds. We're not lowering, you know, I asked that initially.
Yeah, I understand.
And so it's still two-thirds. And I know a lot of times we pass a bill that's contingent upon the effective date of another bill. I'm not aware of anything that would prohibit this. I don't have any objection to taking a look.
We can say we'll check this out again with Mr. Barron's office. He's over the years been very deep into what we can do with effective dates and other methods for getting around what we want to get around. I would like to suggest to the body that if it really is your desire to raise the fee, which I think I said to Mr. Clarkson, that's not really what I'd like to do, but if it's the desire of this committee to raise the fee, why don't we just simply put in the bill that we're raising the fee? And then, even if you want to, give the court the authority to raise it as the cost of living demands in years in the future. But I don't know why we're not just simply doing very bluntly what we say we want to do, which is simply to raise the fee. And that's a lot, and there's no question we can do that, because it all falls within the one subject rule. Mm-hmm. And it would take a two-thirds vote to change the court rule, but at least we'd be doing it in a forthright manner, although, as I say, mine would be a vote against that, but I don't have any particular preference. So
Mr. Chairman, it's fascinating to me, really, that the majority of discussion involved in this matter so far has turned upon the fiscal law, and not the concept of the bill itself. And the concept of the bill itself, the last couple of times it's been considered, there has been somewhat hotly debated about whether or not you should have magistrates who have jurisdiction over people up to that amount of dollars. And maybe it's a feeling at this time of a greater degree of confidence in the magistrate system. I hope it is. But I have no quarrel whatsoever with giving that kind of jurisdiction. I just make it as a matter of note of interest, but it seems to be the substance of the bill, and it's going to be discussed.
Yeah. Mr. Fox.
Let me note first on your question about the merits. I'm still objecting to the merits of expanding the jurisdiction of small claims court without doing something in the mediation conciliation area and in the area of focusing on what I perceive to be the people that need small claims court the most, a typical person without an attorney, low income typically. So that does go to the merits and not just the fiscal. But the question for Ms. Forsythe is, first of all, is it your opinion as the attorney for the court system that the legislature can amend the fee? Is that a matter within the power of the legislature?
Well, certainly the legislature has the power to amend court rules.
Procedural rules.
Right. It seems to me that when we're talking about filing fees, we're talking about something that's so internal to the court's administration, there may be a problem with infringing the separation of powers by doing that. During this discussion, and this is the sort of discussion that just seems to me ought to be conducted administratively within the court system. One suggestion might be that I carry back to the Supreme Court the strong feeling from this committee that we take a look at our fee schedule.
We haven't taken a vote on that matter, so I hope you don't take the message back too quickly. Well, let me suggest that we're providing the money for this proposal,
certainly.
So I don't know that makes it an internal matter of the court system.
Yeah.
The second question on the same matter is, do you believe it's within the authority of the legislature to create exceptions or limitations on the jurisdiction of the small claims court?
I think it pretty clearly is. I mean, the small claims court is a statutory creature.
Okay.
The legislature created it, so I would think
I
that
didn't
want
to cause any problems if I draft a couple of amendments to this bill.
Chairman, it kind of brings me back, I guess, the first bill we started with. The venue is within the jurisdiction of the legislature, and now that we're going to give to the court system, are you saying that that becomes problems for the court system then, and then the legislature, by majority vote, cannot take the venue issue back?
Well, no, I think venue pretty clearly, in every jurisdiction that I'm aware of, is created by statute. That doesn't.
Yeah, but we're going to say it's created by court rule. So then it becomes a court rule that cannot be amended by the legislature other than by two-thirds vote? I may change my vote on that one.
He's
lost one there.
I didn't make my argument strong.
If I could make one observation quickly on that. Anything that you create with majority vote can be repealed by majority vote.
Okay, that that brings me to the next argument. The fee structure used to be in statute. Fee structure for filing fees were statutory at one time. I think, anyway, that might...
Let me pursue, I'm going to counsel Mr. Fox, let me give you my thing. If we give the power of the court to by court rule, establish venue, we can repeal that authority by a majority vote. Now, if they, by court rule, say all cases in Bethel will be heard in Nome, that is a court rule, and if we wanted to change that specific court rule, it would require two-thirds. But if we take a statute that requires only a majority of each house, I mean, Mason's is real clear on that. Anything that requires a majority can be repealed by a majority. In fact, as legislatures in the past have passed laws that said this law can only be repealed by a two-thirds vote of a future legislature, and the courts have repeatedly held that that doesn't count. If it only took a majority to pass the bill in the first place, it only takes a majority to repeal it. But I would agree with you that if we wanted to actually change the specific rule, then the Constitution is very clear that requires two-thirds.
That's a very interesting question.
In other words, we can pull the baby out with one-half, and with one, just the wars, we'd have to have two-thirds.
I guess I'm not convinced you're right, because the scenario would be we pass this law, give them the authority to adopt a venue rule, they adopt the venue rule, we then file a bill that repeals that venue rule, saying that we've changed our mind.
That's not what we'd be repealing. We would be repealing the authority for them to create a venue rule, and I think that's a horse of a different color.
Why don't we get legal opinion?
But anyway,
Mary. On that point, it seems to me that there are two kinds of rules that are adopted by the court system. The first type is a procedural rule, and that the court has inherent authority under the Constitution to adopt, and we can only change that by two-thirds vote. The second type of rule it may adopt is pursuant to a grant of statutory authority, as much as any other agency may adopt, say, a regulation. Most agencies do it by regulation because they're under the Administrative Procedures Act, and the rulemaking procedures are governed by the APA. The court system is not under the APA, and therefore, when we delegate something to it, it's done by court rule. That doesn't make it a procedural rule. It's done pursuant to a specific statute. And I think in that case, the constitutional provision that requires a two-thirds vote is inapplicable because it's not a procedural rule. It's a rule pursuant to a specific statute.
What do you think?
Let's kind of bring this, as much as we've already passed the bill out, let me, unless there's a motion to do otherwise, let me just make this update. Let's ask our legislative drafting people for their opinion on it. We can even go to the AG if we want to. Get the opinion of what the court thinks their authority would be in this area. Because if nothing else, it's very interesting. However, I just assume not discuss interesting things. So we have a specific motion for us. Mr. Fox and then Mr. Phillips.
Would it be appropriate to ask you for a copy of the report of the task force on mediation, conciliation, whatever that task force was?
2 years ago, 3 years ago.
You said there's a recent report out by a group appointed by the court to investigate the use of mediation, conciliation, and arbitration in small claims proceedings.
I don't think that that's what I'm saying. There are two sorts of reports that we might be talking about. One is what's conducted as part of the Civil Litigation Simplification Task Force. And I don't think that's what you're talking about. You have a copy of that from last year. This is the one that I referred to today. The Conflict Resolution Center prepared a report.
Right.
I could certainly provide you with a copy of that.
Do you have one?
Not with me, but I can send you one quickly.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. If there are any in town, it'd be easy to do that.
I don't know if there are, but I might get prepared.
Taylor.
For the record, and for Ms. Forsyth's comments that she's hearing tonight, I'd also like to indicate a strong concern about what Representative Clark has indicated. If we look at the litigation, the lengthy time litigation takes, and that the majority of the construction industry no longer utilizes our court system. Instead, when they have millions of dollars tied up in a major project ongoing, they can't waste the time or afford the time to embroil themselves in litigation. And as a consequence, they've gone to arbitration panels and professional arbiters who can move quickly, give them a prompt response to their question, and then if they have to litigate, they do it after the project is done. And I think think it could be very beneficial, but you're gonna have to have something come up other than just the experiments that have been done, which were all voluntary, where people will commit themselves, that they will not, if they go to the informal one, they don't come into the court system. They are bound by that decision, and that way you can do something effective with them. But I'd certainly encourage it.
What's the will of the committee on this legislation? Do you want to let that sit for at least for the night and discuss it further tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to let it sit even longer if you don't mind, simply because I would like to have the opportunity at least to offer my suggestions for other revisions of the small claims court.
Okay, sounds good.
You know, it's all work on.
Yeah, you'll let me know then, so okay.
You have to help me.
I'm gonna try. Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, unless there's anybody who wants to make any additional comments on that bill, we'll take up 119. We won't. We only have 3 minutes, and I don't think nothing to that.
We didn't do too bad.
No, we didn't do badly at all.
Two bills?
Two bills. Well, one and a half.
Yeah, we
one of them we're thinking over. Right?
You decided you're against it.
Yeah, okay, yeah. unless there's further business, of course, we'll adjourn until tomorrow. The same day. Do you want us to make arrangements for teleconference if it's open so that you can sit on the session tomorrow?
We have to.